As you all know, I'm Mark Smith. I just spoke for a few minutes, and I have the distinct honor and pleasure to introduce our lunchtime speaker, Professor Lerner of the George Washington University Law School. Professor Lerner will be talking about the topic, the Second Amendment and the spirit of the people. This obviously is consistent with our conversation today about the Second Amendment in American life and American law, and what the Supreme Court may be doing in the future about it. Well, Professor Lerner's credentials are, shall we say, impressive. She clerked for Stephen Williams of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia before clerking for the U.S. Supreme Court with Justice Anthony Kennedy. Before she started her career in the law, she went to, I think it's the State University of New Jersey, Princeton University. And then she went to the State University of Connecticut, I think that was called Yale University, for law school. So after Princeton and Yale Law School, she started her legal career. But of course, before that, she decided to take a little break and take a look at something, and actually also decided to give a shot and become a Rhodes Scholar to Oxford. So Professor Lerner essentially has the trifecta. She's got Princeton, Yale, and the Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford. Those are awfully impressive. They won't even let me on the grounds there, never mind in the schools. Now, Professor Lerner, since becoming a professor at George Washington University Law School, she is the Donald Philip Rothschild Research Professor of Law. This is after she worked for the George W. Bush Justice Department in the Office of Legal Counsel, a very impressive and difficult job to get, and she held that position for several years. Now, when I was looking at Professor Lerner's impressive academic credentials, I could not think about today's world of political correctness on American college campuses, and I got to thinking, you know, how is it that Professor Lerner can be a tenured professor so young at a major American law school, having, you know, worked for George W. Bush's administration and clerked for Justice Kennedy? And I was trying to figure this out. And then I realized when I dug deeper into her work where she is a legal historian, I said, ah, if you're a little bit a libertarian or conservative, the way to get tenure at American law school is to write about things that occurred hundreds of years ago. And that apparently is what Professor Lerner has done. So without further ado, I want you to all give me a warm welcome to Professor Lerner to talk about the Second Amendment and the spirit of the people. Professor?
Well, thank you, Mark, for that very generous introduction. Thanks to Dean Reuter and to others who have organized this important conference. And to all of you for coming, and to those who are watching, thank you for paying attention. Of all the rights in the U.S. Constitution, the right to keep and bear arms most reflects the spirit of a free people. It is the spirit of resisting oppression. That oppression can come in different forms: oppression by the government and oppression by private thugs. And as we'll see, and has been mentioned today, the U.S. is not the only place where that spirit of resisting oppression exists. It's growing in other places around the world. Jordan Peterson reminds us, if we needed reminding, that there are genuinely malevolent people out there. They wish us harm. And we must say no early in the cycle of oppression and mean what we say. To do that, he says, takes aggression. That's true, but a better word for the quality that's needed is spirit or spiritedness. This is the quality that the ancient Greeks called thumos. Good thumos is the emotion that drives virtue. It is indispensable to having and keeping virtue. It is the spirit that resists oppression, that causes one to stand up for oneself, one's family, and one's community. It is the spirit of courage and the spirit of self-reliance. Self-reliance, was famously a classic characteristic of the American people. The American people settled a continent in the face of staggering dangers. And there are many excellent accounts of this. But my favorite, and one that I've been reading to my 10-year-old over the past year, is Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House books. Wilder has a long description of Pa carefully cleaning his rifle. She helped him as a 6-year-old girl. She describes Pa at the hearth in their log cabin casting bullets, and again, how she helped him. That rifle, she makes clear, was absolutely essential to feeding the family, because of hunting, of course, and to protecting the family. Here's the thing. When Pa wasn't carrying it, which was fairly often, they kept it fully loaded on hooks on the wall of their log cabin, a cabin that was full of young children. There is never a hint in Wilder's books that there was the least danger of accidental use. Pa and Ma taught the children not to touch the gun unless it was absolutely necessary, and the children understood. The past tells us a lot about the present. Sometimes I amuse myself by wondering what would happen if the typical modern suburban soccer mom went into a house and found a fully loaded rifle hanging on the wall. In certain circles these days, self-reliance is not a popular virtue. The argument goes, we no longer live on the frontier. We have a specialized police force. It will keep us safe. Really? Violent crime has not disappeared. But in America, it is localized. The fear of violent crime doesn't affect me personally much at all. I don't live in a high crime neighborhood. I never have. Most other suburban soccer moms haven't either. I grew up and I currently live in McLean, Virginia, a place that I sometimes like to call the mean streets of McLean. My family roll their eyes. But mean streets and mean places are not a joke for many persons. A friend of mine got interested in carrying a gun for self-defense because of a new job. That job was being a clerk, as he called it, on the graveyard shift at a motel on Route 1 in Howard County, Maryland. After my friend quit his previous job and started work at the motel, he found out the reason for the job opening. The previous night clerk had been murdered during a robbery of the motel. A police officer who stopped by from time to time suggested that he get a permit and a gun. This is Maryland, keep in mind. Such permits were very hard to get. But the police approved his application, probably because they felt bad that they never solved the murder at the hotel. He got a gun right away after that and carried it. Of course, for persons who live in high crime neighborhoods, these sorts of problems are routine. There's a considerable risk if you're walking alone at night that you will be robbed. And that's something that is easy to forget when you're a suburban soccer mom or otherwise upper middle class. Suburban soccer moms are not likely to hear about the many times that firearms are used in self-defense. Over 67,000 times per year, according to a pro-gun control organization, the Violence Policy Center. That is considered to be a low estimate. But what a suburban soccer mom is likely to hear about a great deal are mass shootings. These mass shootings play on the fears of an already quivering and anxious society. And so the call goes out, do something about it. And here's where irrationality sets in. Because the shooter used this particular gun or this particular device, We must ban them. What really creates the danger is not the legality of this or that part. What really creates the danger is so-called gun-free zones. Every major recent mass shooting was in a gun-free zone. Gun-free zones are death traps. Mass shooters know it. We sometimes think of them as totally crazy, but they are not. They are rational in that they deliberately target gun-free zones. They know the persons in them are sitting ducks. They can't fire back. They can't defend themselves. Mass shooters know they'll be able to kill a lot more persons that way. But instead of realizing that gun-free zones are the danger, politicians rush to say that they want to ban this or that device that was used. How effective is that? Let's take a look. And being a legal historian and writing about things that are hundreds of years old, I'm going to take a look a long way back to 1764, to be precise. In that year, the Italian Enlightenment criminologist Cesare Beccaria had something to say about gun control. He is much beloved of progressives these days because he opposed the death penalty. In his own time, he was famous throughout Europe and also influential with the founders of this country. Let's hear what he wrote about gun control. False is the idea of utility that sacrifices 1,000 real advantages for one imaginary or trifling inconvenience that would take fire from men because it burns, and water because one may drown in it. That has no remedy for evils except destruction. The laws that forbid the carrying of arms are of such a nature. They disarm only those who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. He goes on to say that anyone who's prepared to violate laws against murder or robbery would also violate laws against carrying arms. And he says that a ban on carrying arms, quote, would put an end to personal liberty. 2.5 centuries ago, Beccaria nailed it. Criminals find a way to get firearms while law-abiding citizens are disabled. The best example of this is in the UK. I have one hat as a legal historian and another as a comparative law studier. Looking at the UK government boasts that it has some of the strictest gun control laws in the world. Since 1997, following a mass shooting at a school, handguns were confiscated. It's virtually impossible to get a license to carry in the UK. The UK international pistol shooting team has to practice in Belgium. What happened next after the ban in 1997? Crimes involving handguns increased by nearly 40% in the next 2 years and had doubled by 2009. Just last December 2018, there was a long article in The Guardian, hardly a right-wing bastion, talking about how the UK is now in the middle of a flood of illegal firearms entering the country. The police are trying to stop it, but have so far proved unable. They have made it their top priority to confiscate these illegal weapons, and they have not been able to stop the flood. And among the most popular of these illegal firearms entering the UK are handguns. And that's exactly the sort of ban that gun control advocates in the US dream of. Conversely, what do we see when the population is legally armed? In 1987, Florida became the first state with major urban populations to ensure that almost all law-abiding adults can get a concealed permit. Gun control advocates hysterically predicted murder and mayhem on Florida streets. What happened? Violent crime rates went down. License holders almost never misused their weapons. Florida's successful law prompted other states to do the same. Social scientists have yet to find any adverse effect on public safety. The evidence is overwhelming, therefore, that gun control not only does not promote public safety, it affirmatively endangers it. So why does this impulse persist? In part, it's the usual human irrationality and foolishness. But there's also another component that is deeper. That is distrust of the people and the desire to make the people dependent on the government. Ultimately, this leads to the end of government by the people. To see that, we need to take a look at the rationales and history of the right to keep and bear arms. The best exploration of the liberal philosophic basis for the right to keep and bear arms that I know of is an article by Nelson Lund. Liberal thinkers such as John Locke, William Blackstone, Beccaria, and Adam Smith all linked freedom from political oppression with self-defense and personal safety. The right to bear arms, they said, was necessary for both. Blackstone was central to the US founders' understanding of law. He wrote that the right to keep and bear arms was indispensable to protect what he called the three great and primary rights of personal security, personal liberty, and private property. He wrote that this right is, quote, the right of resistance and self-preservation when the sanctions of society and law are found insufficient to restrain the violence of oppression. And so it was for the framers of the US Constitution. The preface about the militia is there because the new Constitution gave the federal government power over the state militias. Some Americans feared that the federal government would use this power to disarm the populace. The militia in those days consisted of all able-bodied men. From the ages of 15 up, by the way. That was the origin of the right, to protect personal security, personal liberty, and private property. Unfortunately, ruling classes over time have taken away the right to keep and bear arms from disfavored groups. The English did this right off the bat. In the English Bill of Rights of 1689, the right to keep and bear arms was limited to Protestants only. Catholics were a suspect and disfavored group, and they could be disarmed. The English decided that they needed control not only over Catholics, but over the lower orders. And this is classically English. The so-called game laws restricted ownership and use of weapons by servants and laborers. Ostensibly, these laws limited hunting, which the upper classes wanted to keep as their own private pleasure and preserve. But Blackstone and American commentators wrote that this was, in fact, a means of political control. Americans had their own disfavored groups. After the Civil War, these included African American freedmen. In the former Confederate states, groups were going around disarming, confiscating the weapons of freedmen. And thanks to Stephen Holbrook for highlighting this history, as for so much else. In response to these confiscations, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, guaranteeing to freedmen the right to keep and bear arms. The 14th Amendment, ratified 2 years later, is widely understood to have, at a minimum, constitutionalized the Civil Rights Act of 1866. In the 20th century, along with the expansion of regulatory government generally, the regulation of firearms expanded. State and federal governments imposed heavy taxes. They prohibited or limited sale of certain types of firearms. And they created gun-free zones, so-called. Some of them imposed complete bans on possession of handguns, and some made it almost impossible for law-abiding citizens to carry a gun for self-protection. These laws primarily affected ordinary persons, not persons who are upper middle class. That this was and is so for two reasons. First, upper middle class persons are usually safe. They live in safe neighborhoods, work in safe offices, and have safe means of transport. They are insulated from many types of dangers that ordinary persons have to face. Gun regulations don't make much difference in their lives. And if such regulations ever do begin to bite, the upper middle class and above can often create exceptions. It was telling that William F. Buckley, Nelson Rockefeller, and Adolph Ox Punch Sulzberger, the publisher of the gun control crusading New York Times, all had a permit to carry a firearm in New York City. And this was at a time when Bernie Goetz, an ordinary Joe, or an ordinary Bernie, had been assaulted and beaten on the subway and was denied one. Let me read that list again. William F. Buckley, Nelson Rockefeller, and Punch Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times. This brings us to an interesting point about gun control and gun control advocates. They are not exclusively progressive Democrats. They include prominent conservatives, such as George Will, the late Charles Krauthammer, and George W. Bush. What do these persons have in common? They are, or were, upper middle class at least, and they are, or were, safe. It's appropriate to analogize gun control laws today with the English game laws. In other words, it's designed by the ruling class to keep control of ordinary persons. Judges and lawyers are very much members of this ruling class, the upper middle class. They are safe. Not only that, judges are especially well protected in their workplaces. Threats against judges are taken very seriously by law enforcement. That might help explain why, apart from the slim majorities and limited holdings of Heller and McDonald, judges have been reluctant to enforce rights to firearms. They don't see the need. Justice Thomas is an exception. Justice Thomas has highlighted the point about judges feeling safe and not understanding the concerns of ordinary persons. He is one of the few justices who has lived in a poor and high-crime neighborhood. There are signs that ordinary persons in other countries are getting fed up with being told by the safe ruling class that they can't have guns. In 2006, I wrote about the clash between the people and elites on gun control and self-defense in the UK and Belgium. Populist movements now have made relaxing gun restrictions a centerpiece. In Italy, there's been a sharp jump in the number of persons who say gun restrictions should be relaxed. This is especially true among the less educated and the elderly. In other words, the most vulnerable persons. Matteo Salvini, a powerful figure in Italy's populist government, made a campaign pledge to loosen gun control restrictions. In September, the government did just that, making it possible to own firearms, including the AR-15. The mayor of a town in Piedmont, in northwest Italy, went even further. He promised to pay each citizen 250 euros toward the purchase of a firearm. The mayor of Florence, who is pro-gun control, is upset. He said, "We've simplified the way to buy yourself a gun. This is an idea of do-it-yourself security." Exactly. And that's what he can't stand. He wants the government to have a monopoly on legitimate force. I need hardly point out that the extensive and immensely powerful crime organizations in Italy are heavily armed with automatic weapons and do not bother with licenses. Brazil is an even more dramatic case. Brazil is undergoing an epidemic of criminal violence. Brazil has the lowest rates of legitimate gun ownership in the region and huge numbers of firearms in the hands of criminals. In February 2018, the Brazilian government sent the army to deal with a wave of violent crime in Rio de Janeiro. Ordinary persons are wearing bulletproof vests. They are trying to bulletproof their homes and cars. School children in poor neighborhoods have become used to lying on the floor during shootouts. Rates of armed robbery are astronomical, and murder. The best one is criminals raid courthouses. Why? Because large amounts of firearms are stored in courthouses as evidence in criminal cases. And the criminals raid the courthouse and steal them. In 2003, Brazil's Congress enacted a gun control law that is appropriately called the Disarmament Statute. Faced with an onerous registration process, many Brazilians surrendered their firearms. It's no wonder that Bolsonaro's campaign promises to relax firearms restrictions proved popular. In anticipation of the change, ordinary Brazilians are training at gun ranges. And one of them, Natalie Ortega in Sao Paulo, who's at a gun range, said this, "Right now, only the criminals have guns. I'm not going to run around the streets with a gun in my hand, but a criminal might think twice if normal citizens could be armed." Indeed. Sometimes these populist movements are derided as fascist. The motive to allow ordinary citizens to have firearms is not fascist. How do we know that? What fascist movements do when they come to power is to confiscate the firearms of disfavored groups and political opponents. That is exactly what the National Socialist Party did in Germany when it seized power. They confiscated the guns of Jews and of Social Democrats. And again, thanks to Stephen Holbrook for writing about this. The National Socialists did not want armed resistance to their violent plans. What we're seeing in the US, in Italy, and in Brazil is a response to ordinary citizens' genuine concerns about safety. This movement is in the liberal tradition. That is the liberal tradition that I described of Locke, Beccaria, Blackstone, and Adam Smith. In contrast, the gun control movement is rooted in an illiberal tradition. We've seen that it's utterly impervious to facts. What then is driving it? Distrust of the people and a desire to make the people totally dependent on the government, unable to think or act for themselves. With extensive gun control, the people, and especially minorities, women, and the elderly, will increasingly be prey to criminal men. This breakdown will cause the victims to turn to the government even more. The government, in response to this crisis of its own making, will continue to expand its already vast powers and personnel. The people will be devoid of self-reliance and devoid of thumos, spiritedness. The problem is deep. Spiritedness is necessary for self-government. Without it, we will become a nation of meek persons dictated to by the ruling class. Fortunately, through their devotion to the right to keep and bear arms, many Americans are demonstrating that they have spirit. Thank you.
So I'm going to ask Professor Lerner to take a few questions from the podium. Is that okay? I'll start with the first to give you guys an opportunity to come to the microphone here to ask your questions of Professor Lerner about that excellent speech we just heard. My first question is, we often hear, Professor Lerner, that in history, once a free people lose their right to bear arms privately, they never get them back. In your historical research across the world, are there examples where people lost their gun rights, lost their rights to self-defense, and then somehow managed over time to get them back? And if so, what are some international and historical examples of that phenomenon?
This is what I think we're seeing right now with respect to these populist movements in many countries. Italy, for example, Brazil. These people have been disarmed, and particularly in Brazil, as I said, with the 2003 disarmament statute. And they're saying, this didn't work, and we need the ability to defend ourselves. And that's why you have the election of somebody who is outside the normal political party regime of Brazil, like Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro says, this is important. We have to make sure that ordinary persons can have the right to bear arms, can bear arms. And that, I think, accounts for a lot of his popularity. So I think that's one example, and Italy then is another.
I'm going to take my prerogative. I have a text message here from a questioner that has this question. Is there any difference in the historical right to bear arms or the historical right to self-defense that you can glean cross-culturally? Is this a Western tradition exclusively? Is there Eastern components to it? Does it matter where in the world or the time? In other words, the right to bear arms among the people, what other societies, you know, embrace this? Again, is it just sort of the Anglo tradition or not? And can you kind of, you know, discuss those other cultures that do embrace this and those that maybe that don't?
The more egalitarian the society, the more likely the people are to be armed. It's just a direct correlation. So the more authoritarian, the more hierarchical the society, the less likely the people are to be armed. And you see many historical examples of that. The Germanic tribe, I mean, you want to go way back, the Germanic tribes, the Scandinavians, had relatively egalitarian societies. The men were all heavily armed. In fact, there's a great line from Tacitus in the Germania. He's describing these barbarian, to his mind, German tribes. And he says, you know, the Germans are really something. He says, we Romans, when we are going to a political meeting, we put on the toga, right? That was a sign that you were part of the polity and you were debating in the polity. He says, the Germans, when they get together and have a political meeting, they carry a spear and a shield. So, again, Rome, a rather hierarchical society, the German tribes, egalitarian.
Great. Question from the audience.
Yes, I'm going to take advantage of your knowledge of what happened hundreds of years ago to ask this question. The phrase in the Second Amendment, well-regulated militia, has been used by the pro-gun control advocates to say that it implies referring to state militias. On the other hand, I've heard that in that time, the phrase regulated militia meant a well-drilled militia. Could you address that?
Yeah. The concern was that the federal constitution did something that anti-federalists were very worried about. The federal constitution gave the federal government the power to essentially commandeer the state militias. And anti-federalists were quite concerned about that. They were concerned about centralization of authority and especially of armed forces. And so what the anti-federalists wanted to ensure was that ordinary persons could still have their firearms, because the fear was that the federal government and its ability to control the state militias would take away their arms. And so in order to preserve this power of the people, the Antiferos demanded that this be inserted in the Constitution, the right to keep and bear arms, so that each individual could do that, and that the state militias could still assemble if they needed to as a well-regulated militia.
Next question from the audience.
I'm pro Second Amendment too. I guess we'd call it devil's advocate. For those who say that if guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns, how do you explain that certain cities in the world with hyper-strict gun controls, you know, Reykjavik, Helsinki, Hong Kong, Singapore, Tokyo, relatively egalitarian societies with a lot of hierarchy, they have strict gun control, but they're some of the safest cities on Earth. So how do you explain that they don't have the acid violence, the knife crimes, the murders of Baltimore, the crimes of Rio and that kind of thing, those other places have, and yet they have strict gun control and some of the safest streets on Earth. How do you explain that? Thanks.
A lot goes into crime rates. Besides ownership of firearms, legal or illegal. And this question goes exactly to that. There are some populations that are highly homogenous, where there just isn't a crime rate in Japan, extremely low throughout Japan. You can't explain everything about crime rates based on firearms laws. There are variations. But it's fair to say, given the same population, you are more likely to have crime when only criminals can have firearms.
You know, I just want to add one point to this because I think this is sort of relevant. In my study of comparative, firearms laws, what I've noticed is that different countries measure crime differently. So several crimes do not count a crime unless there is a victim and you find the perpetrator and you convict the perpetrator. So countries like England do this. So in the United States, if we find a person that's been murdered, that counts as a murder, even if it goes unsolved and we have no idea. In other countries, that's not a murder. They have to actually find the perpetrator and try the perpetrator and convict the perpetrator before it becomes a statistical murder in their crime rates. So there's a lot of shenanigans, and I won't even get into what happens at the local level with police departments trying not to report crimes because it affects their rankings among other precincts in the same city. But to say the least, there is manipulation of crime statistics by a lot of law enforcement agencies around the world is an understatement. And that's why you see some of these, why is the United States has all this crime? And the truth is, they don't necessarily have a lot of crime. They just have a lot of crimes counted versus the other countries that simply don't count crimes as crimes for statistical purposes. So, next question from the audience.
Yes, thank you for your excellent speech. Isn't it true that the right to keep and bear arms was also considered important for Americans in case the federal government, their own government, started becoming tyrannical? I mean, a lot of people today say, well, people don't need to have arms because we have the army to protect us from foreign invaders. But it seems to me, if you read the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson made clear that whenever a government no longer represented the people, it was the right of the people to rise up and basically overthrow that government. So it seems to me that's another reason why the people of the United States should retain their right to bear arms.
Yes, absolutely. That was a component of the Second Amendment. And again, the fear was that the federal government would try to disarm the people through its control of the militias. And with the people having the right to keep and bear arms, that could not happen if that right were maintained. So it was a protection against political oppression as well as oppression by criminals. Absolutely. Those two rights, the right to resist political oppression and the right to personal safety to resist criminal oppression, were very closely linked in Enlightenment thought, and certainly in the thought of all of our founders. That's absolutely correct.
I'll ask one last internet question, and then we'll call it a close. Question for you is this. You have obviously fantastic and elite credentials that are spectacular. We can all agree on that.
I'm a traitor to my class.
So I guess the question is, what can we do to talk to, you know, the Ivy Leagues and to the elites in America, really, to help them understand that their right to keep and bear arms, while they may not need it every day, it's still a very important fundamental rights for the country to keep going and keep this experiment in freedom going for another 200 years. Do you have any suggestions about, you know, what can be done to help that sort of level of elites in society understand what we're talking about here today and the importance of it for them as well as for everyone else?
I think events like this are an excellent way to begin. And that is why I am so glad that this was organized. And I hope that many more will be as well, because it really is hard to get through to people who are safe every day. I have to talk to a lot of people out there because my life does not involve the risk of, hopefully, does not involve the risk of violent crime. It really doesn't. And so I need to get out there and talk to people who are in a different situation, who do live in high crime neighborhoods, who do face these fears. I realize that's an especial problem for judges. Judges, kind of in the nature of things, are isolated. It's hard for them to get out and talk to people. But I'm hoping that with events like this, it will start to occur to them that that might be a good idea to listen to what people are going through out there.
Great. All right, well, thank you, Professor Lerner. All right, that wraps up our first Second Amendment conference for the Federalist Society. Thank you all for coming. Make sure you grab a copy of the complimentary books, in particular Stephen Halbrook's book, the updated 2018 edition of the Founders' Second Amendment. And if I'm not mistaken, Stephen, I believe the U.S. Supreme Court and many other courts have cited to this very book in making decisions on the Second Amendment. So it's a serious book with a lot of great history and reliable enough that many federal American courts rely on the work of Stephen. So again, thank you all for coming, and we'll see you next time.